It is interesting to see that smuggling is present in the contemporary literature, particularly in two forms. First, while the contemporary literary production is mostly written and in Spanish. And here, the use of Spanish has to be seen, is seen by the authors as a way of engaging in an intercultural dialogue with other Amerindian communities of the Americas and with non-Wayuu or Arijuna people, the Wayuu call the non-Wayuu Arijuna. Spanish is therefore an instrument, and so is writing, knowing that the Wayuu community has an important oral tradition. Smuggling has also become a poetical image, a metaphor for an intercultural dialogue, and it is the case of Vito Apxana, a Wayuu poet and political activist, wish to smuggle with dreams with the Arijunas or the non-Wayuu. Therefore, I refer to Wayuu contemporary literature because when it comes to study Wayuu culture, it is important to admit that the concept of literature is plural. The hayechis, which are the traditional song stories, can be considered as forms of oral literature, and the ancestral symbols and drawings in traditional backpacks or mochilas are forms of pictographic literature. Ramón Paz Ípona and Miguel Ángel Jussayú were the first Wayuu intellectuals to give a written and literary form to the hayechis in the 1970s. And in the 1970s, they initiate a literary movement that counts today with approximately 30 writers, whose work goes beyond the inscription of a specific, beyond an inscription in a specific ancestral, local, or ethnic territory by being present in national and transnational circuits. It is therefore central to say that most of that contemporary literature is inspired by a wide mythical corpus which dictates Wayuu ontological principles. And when examining Wayuu history, the community's capacity to act and to create appears as extremely important. Wayuu contemporary literature is inscribed in the history by being at the same time a place in which complex structures of knowledge are actually recreated. Structures of knowledge that have a strong relation with Wayuu cosmology and with mythical thought, but also with the community's history. As a consequence, they engage in complex processes of cultural translation, and here it is important to understand cultural translation not as erasure of ethnic particularities, but as a creation and recreation of ethnic particularities. And so the Wayuu engage also in a contact with Western epistemologies through that cultural translation. Wayuu literature asks the question of the actuality of those structures of knowledge and therefore of their possible contribution to political thinking. And I will ask in this presentation if humanism, understood as human agency and human capacity to create and to imagine new social orders, is compatible with the opening towards the other. And here the other can be seen as myth, invisible worlds, nature, etc., engaged by Wayuu contemporary thinking. And José Carlos Mariátegui, who is a Peruvian Marxist theorist, and his theories on political action and radical humanism allow answering to that question. So my first point is entitled The Necessity to Go Beyond a Subalternist Reading of Wayuu Literature and Knowledge Structures and Towards a Radical Humanism. So Amerindian aesthetic creation has often been read by a critique, be it postcolonial or decolonial, that concentrates on the location of knowledge and ties the political aspect of Amerindian literature and art to an opposition between modern and subaltern epistemologies. Moreover, that literary criticism inspired by the decolonial turn in social sciences explores in detail the representative power of aesthetic production, but by tying it to the subaltern political demands of representation in the public realm. The limits of that conception are that they exclude the politics of creation present inside every artistic and literary work. That is to say, for instance, the presence of political relations of power that determine, surround and are criticized by literary works. And Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari have shown the importance of acknowledging the centrality of the use of language when it comes to examine literature's critical and emancipatory potential. And the French linguist Jean-Jacques Le Cercle calls this departing from Deleuze and Guattari, a Marxist philosophy of language. Postcolonial or decolonial criticism has also the tendency of excluding, when it comes to examining Amerindian literature, which is conceived as subaltern literature, the author's and artist's capacity of aesthetic innovation, and consequently their capacity to reinvent their own ethnicity and to criticize their own production of relations of power. A critique based on the concept of subalternity is also meant to clearly delimitate the political thinking or epistemologies carried by Amerindian literature, which are conceived as emancipatory only when they refer to the knowledge that goes back to pre-Columbian times. And this is very problematic in the specific case of the Wayuu literature, which is deeply entangled with Western epistemologies, because it's a written literature, and it's written in Spanish. Okay, and as I said before, Wayuu history is a history of the recreation of knowledge and ethnicity through the contact with the West and with economic capital. The subalternist and decolonial approach have also, at some extent, excluded a reflection around human capacity to emancipate by approaching political resistance through the concept of difference. And as Robert Spencer argues in his article, Postcolonialism is a Humanism, and I quote, humanism has not been allowed to influence the priorities of a discipline, and here he refers to postcolonial studies, that no longer sees itself, as its predecessors saw themselves, as part of a general movement for emancipation. It is now a trifling affair concerned with the liminal spaces opened up by a global system that it either approves of or, more likely, that it despairs of being overturned. End of quote. According to Spencer, humanism's complex history has to be acknowledged and goes further than the colonialist humanist rhetoric. There is a rich tradition of critical Marxism, and Spencer focuses on, for instance, Marcuse, Sartre, Edouard Said, etc. That tradition can be a rich tool to think emancipation and creation of new social orders instead of resistance against a recoding system. According to Anderson, and I quote, postcolonialism is a humanism because humanism gives us a rhetoric with which to reprove the system of imperialism and both a guide and motive for combating it. Humanism gives us a vocabulary with which to denounce the failings of a form of social and economic organization that sacrifices human potential, human need, and even human life to abstract goals of profit and utility. Humanism also enables us to distinguish reactionary and even fascist anti-imperialism from progressive anti-imperialisms. End of quote. So I believe it's important to ask and study how Amerindian communities, and I will expand with the example of the Wayuu, are proposing ideas for emancipation. In that sense, Amerindian literature is a place in which that project of emancipation is being talked out. And José Carlos Mariátegui, he was the first Latin American intellectual in the 1920s to think Marxism departing from the Peruvian and the Latin American context and history, and in contact and dialogue with the European experience. His Marxism is extremely creative and open. One of its most important features is the insistence on the possibility of overcoming what he calls a decadent social order by creating a renovated society. Literature and arts are, according to Mariátegui, the laboratories for the making of those transforming societies. Indeed, the arts are inscribed in history and political relations of power by carrying at the same time what Mariátegui refers to as myth. and meet has to be understood as an agonistic action, as a fight for the creation of new social orders. In that sense, and according to Mariátegui, for instance, French surrealism, its meat or its soul, which Mariátegui tied to fantasy, is capable of breaking with bourgeois positivism. Similarly, the Amerindian anima, or soul, carried by indigenismo, another literary movement Mariátegui studies, contribute to overthrowing Latin American colonialism. And it's interesting to see that soul can be, does not depend on the person who is writing. It's a soul that can be in every author who has the possibilities of connecting with that Amerindian soul. Okay, and it's interesting also to see that for Mariátegui, the emancipatory or critical power of aesthetics rests in its creative internal power. One of the most interesting features of the Peruvian Marxist thinker is his belief in human potentialities and capacities. Furthermore, Mariátegui's critique allows questioning the substance of that creativity and to see literature as a true place of thinking. Mariátegui's radical humanism ultimately allows to attend the question of the contribution of the political thinking carried by literature to philosophical concepts such as emancipation. So now I'm going to study what your political thinking contribution to the concept of emancipation. So what can be said about what your structures of knowledge or political thinking? Their most interesting feature is that they are the result of the community's contact with other Amerindian groups and with agro-industrial Western societies. Nevertheless, the consequence of those contacts do not imply the loss of what you think in particularities and its relation to the community's mythical tradition and mythical thinking. So in my PhD, I focus on two authors. The first one is a woman who is called Esther Cilia Simán Capuchaina and Miguel Ángel, and the other one is Miguel Ángel López Hernández. Simanca conceives literature as a political weapon she uses to defend her community and also to criticize the relations of power proper to Wayuu people. And this is particularly the case of a young girl's relation to the community. So she criticizes not only the relation between the Wayuu and the Colombian majoritarian state, but also the specific relations of power in her own community. And her short novels and stories deal with direct political questions, such as the problem of malnutrition and the concrete abuses of the Colombian state towards the Wayuu. Miguel Ángel López Hernández has two heteronyms. Vito Apchana writes in connection with Wayuu mythical talk, and Maloy, which is a second heteronym, engages in an intercultural dialogue with other Amerindian communities. Mythical thinking, in particular, other Amerindian communities' mythical thinking, and in particular with the Mapuche in Chile, and he has a strong relation with the Mapuche. So now I will focus on Miguel Ángel López's conception of poetry in order to see which are the elements in Wayuu structures of knowledge that contribute to the concept of emancipation. Vito Apchana's literary production consists on conventional alphabetical and written poems in Spanish. But this doesn't prevent the poet from introducing important elements of Wayuu mythical thinking. For instance, he uses, as I said before, the figure of dreams with recurrence. In Wayuu culture, dreams are the intermediaries between the purasu, or invisible world, and the visible human world. Lapu, which is the Wayuu Naiki word for dreams, is a super vital emissary between both worlds and can be conceived as a creative essence which determines everyday life. The figure of Lapu is related to Wayuu mythical ancestral knowledge by being at the same time recreated in the Guajira daily happenings. In Vito Apchana's poetry, dreams are also the vectors for a dialogue with non-Wayuu people. that dialogue the community intends to create with the Arijunas has to it has to be talked in relation with a major traditional figure, the palabrero. And in relation also with the community's normative system. And according to the anthropologist Wilder Guerra, where your normative system is based on the delivery of material compensations for breach of social norms. The main figure is an intermediary called Puchipu or Palabrero. While your contemporary literature is connected with the political exterior and the intermediaries, the dreams or the palabrero, among others, are rooted in what your ancestral structures of knowledge and contribute building a different way of relating to the other, to the Arijuna or the non-Wayu. The relation is centered on the use of the word, and in Spanish, this is called, that use is called la palabra bonita, the beautiful world. And Vito, his poetry allows seeing that the ones actually beginning with the dialogue are the Wayu, who are somehow in an empowered position. As the poet says, Wayu are establishing a dialogue with the non-Wayu people, with the Arijuna, who seek, the Arijuna are the ones that seek the respect of the Wayu community. That dialogue goes beyond multicultural social relations, which are based on the positing of a strictly circumscribed fixed ethnic characteristics by addressing the question of the becoming Amerindian of the national community. And this is important because the national community also can also have the particularities of Amerindian thinking. Another important factor of the intercultural dialogue which takes root in Wayu structures of knowledge is that dreams, by being the intermediaries between the invisible and the visible worlds, create a particular cosmology in which there is no spiritual transcendence. So the sacred world is constitutive of Wayu daily life. And as the academic Juan Duquesne Winter explains, the supervital beings, and that, for instance, dreams, but also the sun, the moon, the wind, and the rain, belonging to the Purasu world, can have an influence in ordinary life by taking the forms of human, non-human animals, plants, or objects. In such way, Wayu cosmology is close to what Viveiros de Castro calls perspectivist multinaturalism. The way you have a relation towards nature that grounds thinking on alterity. Animals, humans, and supervital beings always have the capacity and the possibility of being others by taking different forms and different bodies. Wayu contemporary structures of knowledge contribute to political emancipatory thinking in that particular relation with nature. Wilder Guerra argues that non-human animals and plants are conceived as persons for the Wayu community, and this relates to a primordial, mythical, and ancestral time. So, to conclude, a critique that begins with a radical humanism present in Mariátegui, for instance, in his theories on political action, allows acknowledging Amerindian structures of knowledge contribution to the idea, to the project, and to the concept of emancipation. It means recognizing Wayu capacity of acting and reinventing the idea of abstract universalism in order to include that opening towards the other, so the non-Wayu, the hidden worlds, animals, plants, and objects, which is at the heart of Wayu contemporary thinking. And according to Maloe, so to Miguel Ángel López Hernández, this means admitting the universal reach of Wayu mystic thought. And I quote, this is a part of a conversation I had with Miguel Ángel last August. We understood that what people call universal is felt from the content, from the entirely human. It does not matter the language and the locality, but what you're saying, the content there. Why does that content make substance and click with the aborigine of Australia or the Botswana? Because it is entirely human. Then, why writing so that everyone understands you? It is demonstrated again and again. Leon Tolstoy said it. I am universal from my village. And the same idea is found here, so in Colombia, in La Guajira, with our García Márquez. Then we don't need to insist anymore on that. Other stentorian and hoarse voices telling us that this is not true, that the universal is a sum of things. What we know is that it is a mystical, extraordinary wisdom that is based anywhere in the globe. Then our elders, our monolingual Wayuu grandparents and grandmothers, are here and they are transmitting that knowledge to their great-grandchildren so that they too are the original bearers of that Wayuu talked in the universe. Thank you.
Thank you for coming out on the last day of the conference. So I made a lot of promissory notes in the abstracts, and I could only fulfill them by writing a 30-page paper, so this is the shorter version of it. So if you have questions about stuff that was in the abstract and it's not covered, we can take it up in the Q&A. Yeah, so in this paper, I want to offer an interpretation of Cabral's account of the Marxist theory of history. So I want to argue that one way in which we can understand Cabral's theory of history is to understand it in relation to two claims that Cabral wishes to avoid. So the first claim is that societies that do not have or have not historically had socioeconomic classes are societies without history. So Cabral wants to argue argues that if one accepts the claim that the history of all hitherto existing societies, the history of class struggles, the famous claim from the Communist Manifesto, without qualifying that claim, then one is committed to the claim that societies without classes and hence without class struggles are without history. Or as Eric Wolff puts it, they represent peoples without history. I argue that while Cabral rejects the idea that class struggle is the sole causal motive behind historical change, he doesn't do so for the sake of upholding a version of technological determinism, as for example G.A. Cohen does in his book on Karl Marx's theory of history. Although it is true that this second claim that I'm arguing Cabral wishes to avoid, this second claim is not really explicitly dealt with by Cabral, but we can have we can develop a reconstruction of his account. I argue that Cabral's theory of history, which posits the mode of production as the main determinant of historical change and development, allows him to argue against the idea that the existence of classes is a necessary condition for the existence of history, qua set of social processes that can lead to qualitative transformations in the societies that are being described, while also rejecting the thesis that technological determination is true. And in the concluding section, I'm going to argue that Cabral's emphasis on using the mode of production interpretation of historical materialism allows him to overcome any kind of culturalist essentialism in his description and analysis of the historical processes of African societies. And I'm going to show how this is relevant for the study of contemporary African philosophy, because I'm trained as a philosopher, so I'm sort of also trying to read Cabral maybe as a philosopher, but also as somebody whose social theory has a bearing on how we interpret African philosophy. So what's the basic problem? The basic question for Cabral is, are there peoples outside history? So in a speech delivered to the first Solidarity Conference of the Peoples of Africa, Asia, and Latin America held in Havana in January 1966, Cabral poses the following question. Does history only be, and here I'm quoting, does history begin only from the moment of the launching of the phenomenon of class and consequently of class struggle? This question exercises Cabral because he is concerned with the fact that maintaining the thesis that the existence of classes is a necessary condition for the existence of dynamic social processes logically commits one to excluding several peoples from the historical process. Provided, of course, that one accepts that at least some societies were classless, an assumption that is shared by Cabral and some of his interlocutors at this conference. Of course, in order to understand what Cabral is asking here, we have to understand what is meant by the word history. So I'm going to give, a general gloss of, what was meant by history in this context. So I think that if one takes into account the Marxist or Marxian, if one prefers that term, polemical context that Cabral is wading into with the speech and his attempt to develop a version of historical materialism that would be suitable for conditions in Guinea-Bissau, one would be justified in thinking that Cabral is referring to a kind of a process of social development or even progress, you know. In other words, the question at hand is not whether peoples without class structures have had a past. I mean, they obviously do. This wasn't in dispute. The question is whether they lived in societies that were dynamic and where such dynamism could lead to qualitative transformations in social relations, such that one could describe those societies as having specific developmental paths that were interrupted by colonialism. So this is another aspect of Cabral's thesis, that colonialism sort of froze the historical process in a lot of African societies. But I'm not going to take this up explicitly. We can maybe talk about it in the Q&A. Cabral wants to argue that they did in fact live in societies that were dynamic, even if, according to Cabral, such societies did not contain classes. Or perhaps he sometimes wavers on this and says maybe they contained classes, but only in an embryonic form. Note that to advance this claim is not to advance the claim that all societies are dynamic to the same degree. This is an independent claim that doesn't follow from the first claim. To show that all societies are dynamic and constantly changing, and that at some point quantitative changes lead to qualitative structural transformations, does not imply that one is showing that all societies have the same rate of change. So I think there is this part which Cabral is not committed to. He's not saying that all societies are dynamic to the same degree at all. And in fact, you know, Cabral could concede that in some societies the rate of change in certain periods of time is so slow that the existence of change might be imperceptible to those living in those societies. So Cabral believed that at least some peoples in Guinea-Bissau, such as the Balanta, lived in a classless society before the advent of Portuguese colonialism. So Portuguese traders were in the region from about, you know, the 15th century, 16th century. Definitely by the 16th century, they had colonized Cape Verde. And they had trading posts in the area that is today the territory of Guinea-Bissau, Senegal, Guinea-Conakry. But Portuguese colonial control over the territory of Guinea-Bissau didn't actually take place until the 19th century as part of the European wave of colonization of Africa. So Cabral also wants to say that insofar as the Portuguese did not really penetrate into the countryside or the rural areas, the social structure of the Balanta was not really transformed significantly. So according to Cabral, colonialism did not structure what he calls bush society. Cabral claims that the Balanta lived in a horizontal or level society. He contrasts this situation to the situation of other groups in Guinea-Bissau, such as the Fula, who lived in a socially stratified society where the surplus that is produced by the primary producers is consumed by a ruling elite, chieftains, and where one could ascertain the existence of class-based hierarchies and some level of class struggle. So Cabral is also interested in this in this context, because most of the successful recruitment by the PAIGC for the struggle against Portuguese colonialism was among the Balanta. So there is a thesis, the idea that, you know, in horizontal societies where there are no chiefs or chieftains to be co-opted by the colonial administration, it might be easier to mobilize people. So this is why Cabral is interested in the Balanta specifically. And historically, the party's recruitment among the Fula was not successful. The Fula, for the most part, under their chieftains, either were neutral or fought for the Portuguese, especially in the later part of the struggle where the Portuguese focused on Africanizing the colonizing army. This is what they called it. So since Cabral thinks that such horizontal societies existed across Africa, Asia, and Latin America before the advent of colonialism, He thinks that to hold that the existence of class struggle and consequently of classes is a necessary condition for the existence of a dynamic society is to deny that those people who lived in horizontal societies lived in dynamic societies. And so I'm going to quote a passage. It would also be to consider, and this we refuse to accept, that various human groups in Africa, Asia, and Latin America were living without history or outside history. At the moment when they were subjected to the yoke of imperialism, it would be to consider that the populations of our countries, such as the Balanta of Guinea, the Kunama of Angola, and the Makonde of Mozambique, are still living today, if we abstract the very slight influence of colonialism to which they have been subjected, outside history, or that they have no history. So Cabral thinks that we should obviously reject this. However, it's important to note that I don't want to say that Cabral thinks we should reject this based on sentimental grounds or something like that. On the contrary, I think that an adequate reconstruction of Cabral's theory of history would show that the main worry here is a worry about a potential explanatory problem. So, and here I'm going to talk a bit about the explanatory problem that Cabral is concerned with. So one potential candidate for an explanation is that he's saying, look, you know, if one believes that those people who live in societies outside history, then one cannot explain the dynamism which is to be seen among those peoples in relation to the liberation struggles. That could be reasonable. So, for example, I mean, I talked a bit about this, that the Balanta were eager for the struggle. So, I mean, I'll give you the passage in case you're interested. So he says, in this bush society, a great number of Balanta adhere to the struggle, and this not by accident, nor is it because Balanta are better than others. It is because of their type of society, a horizontal level society of free men. However, I think there is something potentially problematic about this way of reading Cabral, namely that the fact that those people resisted colonialism and played a crucial role in the eventual success of the anti-colonial struggle does not imply that they were living in societies that were not previously static to some extent. For to claim that they lived in static societies is not to claim that such societies could not be steered into movement through the action of an external force. So the Portuguese, for instance, tried to install chiefs among the Balanta to restructure this horizontal society. And we could see the Balanta reacting against this imposition. I'd give you, I guess, the famous example from Karl Marx, from his 1853 article, The British Rule in India, where Marx claims that that India before the British came was under the rule of Oriental despotism and that Indian society was characterized by stagnatory and vegetative life. However, he also maintained that England is causing a social revolution in Hindustan. And I recognize that Gavin Anderson is looking, you know, at how the later Marx changed his views on this stuff, but I'm not concerned with Marx here specifically. Just I'm giving this as an example. So another, I think, more promising reconstruction is to point out that Cabral is implicitly drawing on the problem that one faces if one thinks that people who live in classless societies live in societies that are completely static, which is that one can't explain how class societies emerge in the first place, since they must emerge from classless societies, at least if one believes, as seems reasonable, that classes have not always existed and that they were preceded by classless societies. And actually, it's interesting that in this speech, he's also worried about the future. So he talks to the Cubans, the part specifically addressing the Cuban people, and he says, you know, so what happens to the historical process after classes have been abolished? And what happens to historical materialism as an explanatory framework? But obviously he's more concerned with the past, but he does gesture at the future, you know. So I think this seems to be a more promising reconstruction because it accords with Cabral's explicit statement that in the general, and here I'm quoting, that in the general evolution of mankind and of each of the peoples in the human group in which it is composed, classes appear neither as a generalized and simultaneous phenomenon throughout all these groups, nor as a finished, perfect, uniform, and spontaneous whole. Cabral is here denying that social stratification along class lines has always existed. He claims that classes are emergent social phenomena, and if this is true, it would follow that there were dynamics of social change in classless societies which caused the emergence of classes. It's obvious that an explanation for the rise of classes cannot refer back to class struggle as a cause. Hence, one must look for another cause. And one cannot deny that classless societies have history without facing a tremendously difficult explanatory problem.
So here I'm going to give a sketch of the sort of Cabralian alternative to a theory of historical materialism that just focuses on class struggle. So here, so historical materialism as a theory of modes of production. So Cabral rejects the reduction of historical materialism to a theory of class struggle, and instead he stresses the centrality of the concept of a mode of production. This concept occurs quite frequently in his writings. According to Cabral, the main cause of historical changes in a given social formation is to be located in the mode of production characteristic of that social formation. Cabral defines the mode of production of a given society as the combination of, and here I'm quoting, the level of productive forces and the system of ownership that is characteristic of a given social formation or society. And so it might be tempting actually to read Cabral as some kind of technological determinist, because he sometimes says things like the following. So here I'm quoting again. The level of productive forces, the essential determinant of the content and form of class struggle, is the true and permanent motive of history. That seems, you know, it's like maybe a functionalist explanation in terms of technological determinism that could be mapped onto G.A. Cohen somehow. But I think when we reflect carefully upon the manner in which Cabral speaks of, for example, in the specific context of the liberation struggle, of the importance of political factors in bringing about social transformations, we recognize that this is, cannot really be an accurate reading of Cabral. Cabral argues that it is not necessary to go through all of the stages in terms of sequences of modes of production that characterized historical developments in Western Europe. He argued, and here I'm quoting, that such progress depends on the specific possibilities for the development of the society's productive forces and is mainly conditional on the nature of the political power ruling that society, that is, on the type of state and or if we like, on the nature of the dominant class or classes within society. And here the specific context is getting into power, control over the state, and in the context of the existence of a socialist bloc, like the 20th century is very specific in this way, because you can have the possibility to sort of leap over stages by drawing on relations with the socialist bloc. And since the nature of the dominant class or classes within society refers to social relations of production that comprise a mode of production along with the productive forces, I think it's clear that Cabral thinks that societal change and transformation is not just exclusively driven by the growth of productive forces. Rather, it is driven by the mode of production as a whole. Note that a technological determinist reading of Cabral cannot even get off the ground, so to speak, because Cabral doesn't seem to have identified productive forces exclusively with technology in the first place. And here I'm challenging, you know, the reading of Cabral that's advanced by Makungu Akinyala, who claims that Cabral, in an African-centered challenge to traditional Marxist materialist analysis, argues that it was not class struggle which was the motive of history, but rather the productive forces of a particular societies which were the motive force of history, whatever the society's social structure. So there are two problems with this claim. The first is that I think the textual evidence, as I've been trying to show, points to the primacy of the mode of production as a determinant of historical change. The second is that emphasis on technological determinism as the correct reading of Cabral's theory of history would not necessarily mean that Cabral is advancing an African-centered challenge to traditional Marxist analysis, given that some figures who may be fairly, I think, labeled as proponents of traditional Marxist analysis, such as Plekhanov, advanced a technological determinist understanding of historical materialism. So there is really nothing distinctively African about this reading of Cabral. I'm not actually that interested in whether Cabral's account is distinctively African. We can talk a bit about that, but I think it's problematic to pose it in this way. So I think if we just a final thing on the technological determinism, I mean, Cabral was trained as an agronomist. And if we look at his practices as an agronomist, as Carlos Schwartz has done, you'll see that, you know, Cabral thought that the ways in which humans cooperated with one another was a crucial element of the productive forces. It wasn't for him just about introducing new technology like tractors or something. And I think this sort of accords with what Marx and Engels say in the German ideology, but I won't quote their account to skip. The mode of production interpretation is appropriate for explaining the history of societies without classes, since while it is true that not all human societies have historically had classes and stratification along class lines, it is true that all human societies have had to produce or produce means work in a cooperative manner on nature in order to sustain themselves. It is also true that in all societies one can identify relations of production insofar as one can identify relations of control over, but not exclusively, labor power, productive forces, and the fruits of production. So you can individuate any society according to its dominant mode of production, regardless of whether it has classes or not. So, yeah, I only have 2 minutes left, so... yeah, okay, so let's do this part. Okay, so moreover, as Cabral is essentially arguing against the reduction of a materialist theory of history to a form of economic determinism. And I think, you know, people often use economic determinism as a kind of synonym for Marxist theories of history. I don't think that's really correct. So Cabral recognized that a correct and more politically useful interpretation of historical materialism would recognize that at least under some circumstances, relations of production cannot be identified independently of political means of control and domination. So here Cabral is trying to theorize. I think he's not explicit about this, but he's trying to theorize about the way in which, for example, the Portuguese utilized corvée labor in Guinea-Bissau. And really, we cannot define corvée labor as a relation of production without directly referring to political domination. We just can't individuate it. Although I have to say that the corvée labor party might have gotten it from his visits to Angola, where it was much more extensively used than in Guinea-Bissau, because Guinea-Bissau was never really of much economic value to the Portuguese. I mean, they kept it because they thought it was necessary to keep it if they wanted to keep Angola, and Angola was very important for them. So Cabral is also looking at other Lusophone countries like Angola, Mozambique. So by resurrecting a theory of history that is materialist but not economistic, this allows him to accord a significant role to politics and political consciousness. It allows him to also accord a significant role to culture, while also maintaining that culture is, and here I'm quoting, dictated by our economic condition and by our situation of economic underdevelopment. How much time do I have? Okay. Thank you.
Wrap up.
Yeah. So I guess I want to say that this approach of viewing African history in terms of modes of production, where you can trace a specific developmental paths, undermines the idea that there is this communalist essence to African thought that's a function of the primacy of the village commune. Because I think if you look at it historically, from the 10th century onwards, at least in West Africa, the village commune was being undermined anyway. And you have the formation of tributary states like the Malayan Empire in the 13th century, which Cabral refers to like obliquely, because he thinks that another phenomenon that's associated with African history, tribalism, was well on its way out actually in the 13th century with the formation of multinational states. I guess I'll stop here.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ke Jianlu. I'm from School of Philosophy, Beijing Normal University. My speaking title is What is the Philosophy of Marx Based on Historical Materialism? In the German ideology, Marx and Engels clearly declares that philosophy and the study of the actual world have the same relation to one another as onanism and sexual love. In Anti-Dorian, Engels said that which still survives independently of all earlier philosophy is the science of thought and its laws, formal logic and dialectics. Marx thought of eliminating philosophy caused a different reading, especially after Marx's death. Most of the theoreticians of the Second International, such as Bernstein, Mehren, and did believe that Marx and Engels were seriously when they talking about eliminating philosophy. In Italy, Labriola believes that there is philosophy in Marx. It means philosophy of praxis and or philosophy of life, which was developed as philosophy of praxis further by Gramsci later. Giovanni Gentile also regards Marx's philosophy as a philosophy of action. In Russia, even before Labriola, Plekhanov believed that there is a philosophy in Marx, and he clearly named it as dialectic materialism, which was developed by Lenin further. In early the 20th century, influenced by Lenin's October Revolution, Western Marxists such as Lukács, Kirsch, criticized the determinism of theoreticians of the Second International, and clearly put forward that there must be philosophy in Marx. But they look at and Kirsch, they also oppose the Diamat as a philosophy of Marx, which gradually became a Stalin textbook of Marxist philosophy. Diamat was regarded as a philosophy of Engels or Plekhanov and Lenin by the Western Marxists. Since the Cold War finished in early 1990s, what is the philosophy of Marx has been a topic discussed by Western left scholars. In 1993, Etienne Balibar published his book titled The Philosophy of Marx. In 2002, Tom Rockmar published his book Marx After Marxism, The Philosophy of Karl Marx. Since the 1980s, influenced by Western Marxism, including Jürgen Levin School of Praxis, Chinese Marxist scholars began to criticize Diamat and praxis materialism or ontology of praxis based on theses on Feuerbach by Marx. And the German ideology was regarded as a philosophy of Marx by many Chinese scholars, though Diamat is still official textbook in China nowadays. But entering the 21st century, praxis materialism was discussed by more and more Chinese scholars. So historical materialism was regarded as a philosophy of Marx by many by the main Chinese Marxist scholars. Around 10 years ago, there was a hot debate concerning of whether historical materialism is a positive science. And Marx thought of eliminating philosophy was emphasized by many scholars once again. In some Chinese scholars' eyes, philosophy of Marx is neither dynamic nor praxis materialism or historical materialism. So, is there any philosophy in Marx? Based on philosophy of Marx being different from Marxist philosophy, I argue that Marxist philosophy could be dynamic or historical materialism, or dynamic and historical materialism. But none of them could be philosophy of Marx. Here I distinguish between Marxist philosophy and philosophy of Marx. My viewpoint is that philosophy of Marx is political philosophy based on Marx's ethics of communism, which is the concerning of Marx's ideal of an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. In the period of his doctoral thesis, Marx is a liberal. Then he transits to a Republican in the period of Zeitung. In critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, Marx becomes a philosophical communist. Marx stays in the period of philosophical communism till in Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts of 1844, even in Thesis on Feuerbach. Based on historical materialism in the German ideology, Marx becomes a scientific communist. Ideal of communism is Marx's political philosophy, and political philosophy is Marx's philosophy in his lifetime. According to Marx's later work, Critique of the Gott Program, in communist society, the idea of right will disappear. Distributive justice is not the main issue in communist society. Now, Marx cares more about the free, full, and all-round development of each individual. It means the self-realization of each individual. So, I disagree with G.A. Cohen, a British philosopher. G.A. Cohen's critique of Marx. According to G.A. Cohen, Marx regards capitalism as injustice, especially exploitation, because Marx is still standing on the ground of self-ownership. In fact, for Marx, the idea of right has been beyond in communist society. This is my main idea. Thank you.